stretch for the time. Hi, everybody. I'm Kathy Shires, and I'm an alcoholic. All right. Wow, there's a lot of people here. It looks quite different when you're sitting up here. I want to thank the committee very much for asking John and I to be here. It is truly an honor. Not only would I have not been able to do this, you wouldn't have wanted me to do this years ago. I still have some pretty flowery language at times, and but at least I have enough good sense and decorum not to use it up here. All day today, I was wondering what it is that I'm supposed to be doing up here. Feel very much out of my league. My sobriety date is January 4th of 2007. I have had a couple of relapses in this program. And actually, I talked to my friend about that, saying, you know, I've only got 2.5 years sober. I don't know what it is that I'm doing up here. And when I saw the camera, I thought for sure it was definitely the elaborate taping of an A&E intervention episode. So it's viewing, you know, airing in about 6 weeks. You know, and really, when I tell you my story, you'll see why that would totally be understandable. It was only a few short years ago, 3 years ago, that I was standing up from a podium such as this, not at a conference, but telling my story, and was absolutely high. I am the person who, from about year 10, had opened a door and started fooling around with pills in a way that I wouldn't like to have advertised, and picked up year 11 and year 12 and was not sober. And to all appearances from the outside, it looked as though I was a possibly stellar member of AA, sponsoring people, member of a home group, chairing meetings, giving of my time, and absolutely dying of alcoholism. I'm hoping, and I've, you know, if you have any problems with what I say, then you can take it up with the big power source, because I've asked for God to speak through me. And because honestly, I sometimes wonder if I have the capacity to be honest. I am the girl who has no problem living a double life. People would say, how could you have possibly picked up those year chips and still and been high? Very, very easily, you know, because I'm a girl that likes to have their cake and eat it too. I want to have the ego status that I had somehow acquired in Alcoholics Anonymous and yet still seek relief whenever I felt necessary. Eventually that turned into a daily thing that could have just about killed me until I finally got sober on January 4th of 07. There's a part in the book that talks about the personal stories, and it says that in each personal story, the person tells how they establish their relationship with God. And that's what I think I'm supposed to talk to you about tonight. I went first because my husband's the funny one, so you end up with the funny in a minute. So I'm the person also that came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 18 years old, believing that that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. I was pretty staunch atheist, except for I'm way too lazy to read all the books like Nietzsche and stuff like that to be able to have a windy argument with you. It's just the way that it is. You know, there just isn't a God, and I thought that whatever 90-something percent of the people in the world were completely delusional. It wasn't always that way. I never really grew up going to church. I grew up in an alcoholic home. We didn't get out much. It's funny, I'm an only child, and I thought that growing up in this, my mother was an alcoholic, and I thought that because of all the experiences I had as a child, I was convinced that's why I was so damaged, why I was an alcoholic. And I love when I speak with my husband, because I always thought if I had his upbringing, I wouldn't be so screwed up. And yet, he talks often that he kind of wished on some sick level that he had had my upbringing so he'd have something to hang his alcoholism on. So, So, you know, and I had tons of therapists later on in my sobriety that would have grieved with me that I had been very damaged. But I can stand up here and tell you that my upbringing had nothing to do with my alcoholism unless you look at it as a genetic component. But I was convinced that only losers drank and took pills and smoked and all those things. I thought, why in the world would anybody do something like that? There was a lot of violence in my home. My mother really would have been, you know, sleeping in the park if it hadn't been for my father taking care of her. And it was pretty scary on a lot of days. But if somebody had asked me back then, do you believe in God? I would have said, sure. I think my mother, in an effort to just ship me off during the summertime, sent me to like vacation Bible school for a couple of weeks. And that was my only introduction to God of any kind. But for a long time, if you had asked me, I would have said, sure, I believe in God. But I really was way too narcissistic to give it a minute's thought. I do remember very distinctly some of the arguments and the fights and the dishes broken and the screaming and all this kind of stuff and praying to this God and saying, God, please take me out of here. Please get my mother sober. Please stop this fighting. And in my mind, God, forsaken me. You know, it never came through. And I don't remember being disgruntled about it at the time. But by the time I was about 15 years old and somebody asked me about believing in God, I said, sure. And they said, all he asked was, well, why? And I said, well, I don't know. And after I got off the phone with him, I must have sat up late that night thinking, why do I? And all I had to do was start replaying all these scenarios in my head. And I was, you know, the first thought is, God doesn't care about me. I mean, I'm way too self-centered to think about the wars and the famines and all that stuff. It really was just about me. And the idea of God, you know, not caring about a little child was so painful that in my, you know, quizzical, intelligent mind, I thought, in one night, I basically said, wait a minute, there isn't one. I mean, it was just overnight. All it took was a little bit of thought, and I thought, wait a minute, that's the most obvious answer. I can pretty much show from that moment on how my life went absolutely downhill. I started drinking when I was 15 years old, and, you know, it wasn't peer pressure. And like I said, I've been telling my friends who drank they were total losers and didn't understand, and I was on a trip to Florida with some friends, and my aunt was the only person in charge. And we got this wild idea, talking amongst each other, that we wanted to get drunk and see what that was like. And so I convinced her to let us buy some booze, and we went to the grocery store. And I don't even know if you could still get these, but they were like the 2-liter bottles of coolers. And they had about 6 flavors, so we got every one. And there were 4 of us drinking, like as if we needed all this booze. But we had an absolute ball. And the magic that's in that bottle happened for me. And really, that was the first time I found a power greater than myself that solved, I thought, all my problems. It wasn't that I was a kid who, you know, couldn't have fun and couldn't play or whatever, but as soon as I kind of got to be a teenager, you know, all of a sudden the self-centered fear really started hitting me pretty bad. And, you know, I knew from probably the age of 7 that I wasn't quite right. Something's not right with me, and I can't put my finger on it. But I distinctly remember my parents one time going into a store back in the day when you could leave the kids in the car, and it was kind of cold, the windows fogged up, and I'm drawing all over the car windows. And I wrote, I will never be normal, on the back window. And I was about 7. And of course, I knew this was not good. When they came back out, I quickly rubbed it away. Like, I knew this was not something that somebody should see. But, I mean, obviously there are problems from the word go. And alcohol melted those away. That started a 3-year stint with alcohol, and I ended up picking up drugs as well. They're a little part of my story. I try not to dwell on that too much, but just suffice it to say that I am a real chronic alcoholic and an equal opportunity drug abuser. So I proceeded to treat my body like a trash can for 3 years. At the end of those 3 years, I basically prayed to die every day. This God that I didn't believe in, it's funny how. Even if you don't believe in it, you still say those bathroom kind of prayers. And I prayed for God to take my life. And as my sponsor says, eventually he did. But it didn't look the way that I thought it was going to look. And I would be so angry the next day that I was still breathing in here. I got into crazy relationships. It was just insane. And all this time, I'm thinking, there is no way that I have a problem. Because I looked at what the kind of person my mother had been. She had died of alcoholism when I was 13, at 39 years old. And I thought, that's an alcoholic. No way. What I'm doing, I'm just having fun. And I really felt sorry for people who didn't party like I did. I didn't hang out with anyone who didn't party like I did. I love when they talk about seeking lower companionship. Boy, you should see some of the people I hung with. Woo! Some of them might be in this room, actually. I might need to look around and see. Any truck drivers in the room? They had the best drugs, by the way. They went cross state lines to get them. The reason I didn't think I was an alcoholic is because to all outward appearances, I had it together. So again, living a double life is something that I am very comfortable with. It's not something I'm proud of. But I was the kid that graduated high school with honors, who had all the pins and cords and accolades and scholarships and all that kind of stuff. And yet all of my druggy friends who were out there, half of them had quit school, were just, woo, you know, and all I could think about is I can't wait to get that cash in hand and run off to Florida and blow it all. You know, I just thought, when is this ceremony going to be over, you know? I'm kind of a club girl, and I really thought if I could have designed my life that it would have looked something like this. I would have probably, well, number one, I thought I was going to be just discovered and be put in some movie or something. I wouldn't have to do anything. I would just be walking down the street. Somebody go, you'd be perfect for this role. So I was kind of waiting for my day to arrive. In the meantime, I was hanging out and starting, you know, going to school and eventually college. And I thought, you know, if I could just kind of maybe smoke pot every day during the week, just to kind of chill me out. And on the weekends, do a lot of ecstasy and drink cocktails, the pretty ones, all night long, that would have been fine. I could have done that for the rest of my life. I would have killed myself. You know, because I know alcoholism is very, very progressive. And I love one of my buddy Bob says, is that real alcoholics should never do drugs. I mean, I take it absolutely to the limit. And I mean, there were several things I actually put down before I ever came to AA. And it kind of came to a head because I was hanging out in these clubs with these drug dealers. And I was dressed to the nines and I was 17 years old going to these over 21 clubs. And they were, you know, trafficking drugs. And one of them had been set up by the DEA. And I showed up on the day and got arrested along with them by the DEA. And, I mean, if you could call me a normal a normal partier, I mean, I'm the one who stands out amongst all my loser friends. Is like, how does it feel to be a person who will use anything at any time? I didn't even see that as an insult at the time. I thought, pretty good. but I end up getting arrested, and you would think having this court thing over you, I was terrified of going to jail, that I would have quit. But I really thought, if you had my life, you'd drink too. I mean, I just couldn't face a day. I was living in fear and terror and absolute paranoia every day. I mean, I'm the person that's like thinking my phones are tapped and bugging out the windows, and, you know, I mean, I'm just really in bad way. And I ended up having a couple of those tests turn out dirty. And so out of fear, they wanted me to bust my friends. And I didn't want to seem uncooperative. And yet I just couldn't do it. So I ended up saying I'm going to commit suicide. And in a last desperate attempt, called Charter. And the guy brought me in and I talked to him. And I basically cried and screamed and just threw up all over him for 2 hours. And he arranged for me at 18 years old to go into Peachford Hospital. And I went there with no intention of staying sober. I'd never even really tried to quit. I just kind of tried to moderate. I can't moderate. But I go there and really, you know, because I have this court case over me, you know, I agree to stay there and then go to a halfway house for a few months. And something happened to me there. I started to believe what people were telling me that, I mean, really, the list of what I wanted out of AA was just happiness. That's all. It had been a long time since I had known what that was like. And if I did have it, it was usually chemically induced. And so I stayed sober for 5 months and ended up still having to go to prison at 6 months sober for 6 months. And the only thing that's really interesting about that is that they, you know, they made their homemade hooch alcohol and let the stuff ferment in the walls and occasionally would have a batch. And I'm sitting here, I'm in Kentucky, and I'm sitting here thinking, you could drink. Nobody would ever know. You could totally go back and get your one-year chip and do your cartwheels down the aisle and all this kind of stuff, and nobody would be the wiser. And immediately, right after that, it's like an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other, and the angel said, but what if those people in AA are right? Just what if? And what if you're never going to be happy? You know, and so I refused, and that was when I first made the first turn, really, towards sobriety. I did get out of there, and I went to school in South Georgia, and I stayed sober for 4 years, pretty much on fellowship. I had court-ordered therapists that I had to go to, and I had to fulfill that, had to work and pay back money, a lot of money to the federal government. But I made a host of friends down there, and it was brilliant. It was a lot of fun times. And, you know, I thought when I got sober that I would never be able to go dancing again. And I will be the first person out here, by the way, on Saturday night. So if anybody who's afraid of dancing, come see me, because we have a good time. It's good for the soul. But I end up meeting some friends, and we would go out dancing. We have barbecues. We go to meetings together, you know. But this is sort of what my AA experience looked like then. I left the sponsor at the meeting. I got one in name only, and I would see her at meetings and tell her, you know, about this really big thing that happened the other day and how I worked it out and kind of just fill her in on all the details. Never call when I needed to. I often made choices on going to meetings because the cute guy's car was in the parking lot. I took AA very much like a cafeteria line, you know, and I took the, like, you know, the good stuff, like the bread and the dessert and stuff, and left all the meat and potatoes on the line. And if somebody had asked me if I was working the steps, I would have said sure, because I was doing these Hazelden worksheets and stuff with this therapist or whatever, but I wasn't working the steps out of the big book with a sponsor. And I don't know that I would have thought, how could it be any different? Later on, I found out it could be a lot different. But I worked with this therapist, and she tried to help me. She really did try to help me. But I got really easily sidetracked into some, I mean, I guess what could be considered outside issues. I mean, I really did feel damaged. I really felt like I had suffered from depression my whole life. And I really thought, you know, I know I have alcoholism, but there's so much more complexly wrong with me. I really was a terminally unique gal. And I thought that I needed a lot of outside help. And I can tell you that I did do a lot of those things, including medications and stuff like that. And I can stand here today and tell you that I am medication-free, outside help-free. I don't suffer from depression anymore. And all this alcoholic has ever had was spiritual depression. You know, my spirit got smothered with me, and I couldn't get me off of me, and I am absolutely self-absorbed, you know, and it's hard to see beyond 5 feet of me. And even if I saw you, I was thinking about how you were thinking about me. That's about as far as I thought. So at 4 years sober, I'm pretty miserable. And they say that the same person will drink again. And I remember looking in the mirror on more than one occasion going, I don't know who you think you're fooling, but you were the same old girl you've always been. I mean, I was having these underground sort of relationships with people that I didn't want to tell my friends about because they say, why are you dating that loser, you know? I was, like I said, making decisions based on meetings, not out of, because it was a good meeting, didn't join a home group, none of that kind of stuff. So when I had gotten a job, I really thought that when I left South Georgia and got back to Atlanta, where I wanted to live, and got a job and got on my own and out from my grandmother's thumb, that I'd be fine. I kind of held on for that moment, right? And then I came back up here, got the job, got the apartment, and I wasn't. Because what's wrong with me cannot be fixed out here. Even though my ego constantly tells me that I need a relationship, or I need a new place to live, or I need a new job, or, you know, something like that. But none of that is true. I mean, I know people that are locked up in prison that are lifers that are involved in AA in that prison that were freer than me. And so I was on a plane trip going to Minneapolis for training for this job, and they sat me in first class, and the lady next to me, little old lady, you know, ordered a bottle of rum, one of those little tiny, oh, they're so cute, those little bottles. And I ordered a Coke at first. And I was unprepared when my moment came. And they say that a time will come when the only thing that will stand between you and a drink is God. And my time came, and I had no God. I had only prayed those first 4 years when I was in abject misery and pain. And as soon as it lifted, I never gave a minute's thought to God. In fact, if things were really going well, I'd be like, God, we really got this going well. You know, I never once thanked God for anything. And really, I think I still blamed God for my upbringing and stuff like that. It was an old idea that I couldn't seem to get over. So it was hard for me to have a relationship with that God. And so I relapsed, and I just drank. And that was pretty important, because when I came in at 18, I was really pretty well convinced I was a drug addict, but I had my doubts about being an alcoholic because of, like I said, my mother was an alcoholic, and that was a clear case. So I started having the cravings, the mental obsession, all those kind of things came true for me, and it didn't take me long to get my rear end back here. And I quickly assessed what I wasn't willing to do, which was pretty much all the basics. I didn't join a home group. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't work the steps. And you could have hid something from me, my big book, and I'd have never found it. So I had to start going to a big book study, and I got a sponsor that I met with. She took me through the book. And lo and behold, I had kind of the second pink cloud, and it was brilliant. And I was on fire for several years. Started sponsoring people, met my later-to-be husband, and we got engaged and moved away, and life was really good for a while. As I moved from Connecticut for a few years and then to London, England for 4 years, and each time I moved, I got further and further away from my personal recovery. Like I said, it looked right on the outside. And we, you know, had a couple of kids, and it looked like the dream come true, AA marriage and AA life. But I was dying of alcoholism. And, you know, I've been instructed getting up here tonight to hopefully speak to the me that's sitting out there. I hope there's one person, maybe, that's either not really sober and you're hiding that thing from everybody, or maybe you're on your way out and you don't even know it. Because I was on my way out incrementally year by year and had no idea, really. And then again, I kind of held on to that thing, well, in England, I'm just dying. I thought, you know, when we get back to Atlanta, it'll be okay, because we'll be back in familiar meetings and people we know, and it'll be okay, and I can find a sponsor there. Because I was sponsoring people, and yet I couldn't find a sponsor. Not that I was looking very hard, mind you. And I was massing resentment and fears. I had these two small children that were absolutely driving me insane. And I would call some of my friends. Barbara's one, nodding her head. And I'd say, I'm going to kill this entire family. I was like, help me, I'm going to kill them all. And people tried to help me, you know. It's just that I had self had reasserted itself in my life, front and center. And, you know, I really believe in the triangle, that you got to have the unity, the service, and the recovery. And one of the triangles was falling off, and the well was going dry. And my sponsees became more like friends, because I was dying of loneliness, as only alcoholics can understand that kind of loneliness. It's pretty miserable. So when I came back to Atlanta, it was not the end-all, be-all fix. And even though, again, going to meetings and starting a home group, and it looked all okay to all appearances, but the people who were closest to me and knew me knew that I was dying. And they didn't know what to do. They had no idea. And so when my daughter was born a few years ago, we had life happens. I mean, you know, the bad stuff floats around. It's going to land on somebody. And it happened to land on us at the time. And again, I was totally unprepared. I had not paid my spiritual insurance premiums for that day. And my daughter was born, my third child, and she had had a stroke in the womb and had special needs, and I'm in abject terror for her and what's this going to mean, and feeling very sorry for myself. And within days, my grandmother, who was kind of like my mom, had fallen and shattered her leg, and so she never returned home. So all of these big things were happening, and I felt very helpless. And I would go down with my infant daughter to go see my grandmother and visit with her for a weekend, and, you know, just got to kind of looking in the cabinets. I'm good at going through people's cabinets, by the way. I like to see what you got in there, you know. I might need something sometime. And that's really about the first place I wanted to go in anybody's house, by the way. I try to stay out of your bathrooms today. My grandmother had some pills laying around that, you know, from a past arm break or whatever. And I thought, you know, just one to take the edge off. It's all right. So I took one, took the edge off, and the worst thing that could have ever happened. Absolutely nothing. I got the relief I was seeking. The world didn't open up. Nobody knew, and I swept it under the rug. And I could proceed to do that a couple of more times going to see her. And so I opened a door, and I never admitted that to anybody, of course. It's so silly on those chips that says, the time to call your sponsors before you drink, not after. Because I promise, if I'm not doing what I need to do and the obsession's on me, it's too late. It is way too late. I'm not calling a soul because I'm going to go for the relief. That's why I stay really busy in AA, and hopefully I'm not brought to the point of mental obsession, because it's over if I get there. So when my grandmother passed away, and about 6 weeks later, my husband blew his knee out, and woo, vacation day, it's wonderful, the pills are in the house. And I'm supposed to be Miss Sober Wife and giving him his medication. Here's one for you, and two for me, and two more for you, and five for me, and he's none the wiser. I mean, he's blitzed, you know. I mean, he's bedridden for 6 weeks, and I'm running around, and I found that actually that medication gave me loads of energy. Who knew? And that's exactly what I needed, was a little bit of pick-me-up, because I'm playing nurse, and I got these three kids and all this stuff and a sick husband. I needed those. I needed every drink or drug I ever took. I promise. I needed every one. So that started me on that relapse that I was talking about earlier, and within about 9 months, I'm up to about 20 or 25 a day. And like I said, speaking, sponsees none the wiser, husband none the wiser, and living a big fat lie. And so really on January 3rd, I had already planned that I needed to jump ship and get sober, because it was pretty clear that life had become hopeless and futile. And I probably could have scrambled around and kept it going, but when you have that kind of habit, what, for 3 days, 10 days? I mean, I really couldn't see myself doing this forever. And, I mean, my poor husband could have come home one day and found me convulsing and not known what had happened. And so I devised a plan, as we do. I'm always cooking up a plan of some kind. And I said, well, if I quit drinking coffee and quit smoking cigarettes, everybody's going to expect me to feel really bad. You can see the flaw in this plan, I'm sure. Anybody who's ever done those things can certainly see the flaw in that plan. And so on January 3rd, I took about 15 of those lovely tablets and jumped ship. And the next day, I put down the coffee and put down the smokes. And absolutely went crazy. By about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm laying in the bath because I'm starting to get the aches. And it's just beginning. And I remember laying in the tub, and I started talking to God. And I said, you know, what are you afraid of? You know, and really the thought that came so clearly was that it's more important to save your ass than your face. And if I could have done it, I probably, knowing the person I am, I would have come off of those. If I could have stayed off of them, I don't think that I could have, and gone on and kept picking up those chips. Because I am a liar through and through. Like I said, I'm not sure what it is I'm doing up here. But I obviously have no moral compunction or conscience. And But I couldn't do it, and my husband came home early to check on me, and I said, I got something to tell you. And I started to cry, and I had this big buildup, and I'm trying to tell him, and he's like, for God's sake, just tell me. And I said, well, I've been abusing pills. And he said, oh my God. He said, well, do you want to be sober? And I said, yeah, I do. I need help. And he said, well, thank God. He said, I thought you were going to tell me you were having an affair and you were leaving me. And he said, I don't know what I'd do about that, you know. We know what to do with the pill problem, you know. So I got sober again on January 4th, and a lot of things changed. Sorry to say, for those of you who relapse time and time again like me, never had another pink cloud. That was gone. I knew what the kind of work that was ahead of me, and life changed. I mean, I was going to certain meetings, and a lot of that changed. I lost a lot of friends, some by choice, some by just not running into them anymore, and I felt very alone, but I got a new sponsor, and within a few weeks, I'm flying to Virginia to do my inventory with her, my fifth step, and we started on this path. And one of the things she told me to do was, well, if you're going to a lot more meetings now and trying this thing again, I highly recommend you get to at least one treatment center meeting or a VA meeting or something every week. And that was something I'd never done. I said, well, what do I have to offer? I can't sponsor these people. I've got like months sober. She said, I don't care. She said, you've got a message to offer to those people that have 3 or 4 days, and you can welcome them and all that, and so you need to get out of yourself. So I started doing that. And slowly but surely, I mean, I was up and down for about 9 months. You know, I would just all of a sudden snap into a really low, low, and I have to call them, and I have to pray through it, and it was not fun to kind of sit through. Convinced that if I just had a little bit of, you know, some kind of antidepressant medication, I'd be good. And she said, either you use spiritual power and quit relying upon the human realm to solve your problem. You know, and I always was looking for something in the human realm. And so I kind of, once I hit about 9 months, it kind of leveled out. And the cool thing about today, because I want to make sure I let John get up here and talk, because like I said, he's the real funny one. About, you know, a couple of years ago, our home group that we helped started kind of fell apart. We realized we weren't doing a lot of work with a lot of newcomers. There was not a lot of new blood coming in. We were kind of like the sober Elks, as one of my friends likes to put it. You know, we kind of came together to talk about the big book to each other. And we all knew the big book. I mean, you know, who's that helping? Once we started talking about doing some different things with the group, it fell apart. And that is as it should be. So I was kind of without a home group for a while, and I had committed meetings that I went to and met some great people and that I really care about, really good friends. But I realized that really what I wanted was a home group. And when we had moved to Connecticut, we had helped start a home group. It was the first one really I'd ever been involved in because I wasn't really involved with one here. And I saw the importance of that and the importance of doing your service there and supporting it more than any other place in the world and working with people. And we really wanted that. And so actually this May, we finally, with a group of the most enthusiastic, excited bunch of folks you'd ever hope to meet, we started the Fifth Tradition Group. And it opened the middle of May. And so far, it's been doing really well. And it fills me up. And it's not John and I's meeting at all. It's everybody's meeting. And they are just, I am so privileged to be a part of such a fantastic bunch of people. And I've seen the lights come on for other people. And we take a meeting into Peachford Hospital once a week. And we get out there and work with those new people. And we're really scooping them up and trying to show them a solution. And, you know, even during the dark years when I was sober, and even when I was fooling around with the pills, I would pray the third step prayer every night. You know, it's one of my most favorite prayers. It was actually used in our wedding. You know, but when I say relieve me of the bondage of self, you know, I don't think I knew for a long time really how bad it was or what that meant. God's, in his infinite humor, has decided that because if I'm left alone for 15 minutes to walk the dogs around the block, I start thinking some crazy stuff about myself and coming up with some interesting plans and designs. God's answer for that has been loads and loads of people to work with, more than I've ever had. And I keep saying, well, you know, I'm a stay-at-home mom and I got these kids at home and all these other things going on. How can I possibly have the time to devote to these people? And what about me? I mean, that's really what I'm asking. What about my time, you know? I promise I get plenty of me time. That's never been a problem, actually. I work that in no matter what. And yet, I'm working with more people than I ever have, and that's been God's answer to me. Because when I sit down with that person, whether, you know, I'm sitting down reading the book with them or I'm talking to them on the phone, I am relieved of the only thing I ever have to be relieved of, you know, the bondage of self. And I'm thinking about them. I'm into other-centered activity. And for such a long time in AA, there were so many things I wasn't willing to do. And give of my time was probably at the top of the list. And now it's a true joy. And really, that's where I get the high from here. You know, I am lifted up. And I, you know, one of the cool things that I'll shut up with is the fact that, you know, that Melissa came up here to introduce us. Because Melissa is one of my sponsees that I actually had when I was still using. And I, when I got honest about it, I said, you know, most people would recommend that you get another sponsor. I highly recommend it, but I'll leave that up to you. And she said, well, even if you were using and high or whatever, you kept me in the book. You kept me in the solution. It was never that I didn't think this worked and that I didn't think God was there. I was unwilling to do it, you know, personally. And so she stuck with me, which is really funny. And it is so cool to have seen her walk up here and do this. Because if you knew her even a year ago, there is no way she'd have done it. She'd have come up with, I got the swine flu, anthrax, I mean something. There is no way she would have come up here. And through the home group, you know, and I mean she prayed to have the fear removed for a long, long time and yet stayed at home. You know, came to the meeting and went home and wouldn't go out to coffee with us and wouldn't come and do stuff with us and wouldn't be a part of outside of that hour meeting. And, you know, there's a saying that, you know, without God, I can't. But without me, he can't, you know. And in the last couple of months, as we started the home group, she has bust out and is sponsoring people. And I've watched the fear melt away because she's been willing to do some things that she was prior to unwilling to do. And let me just tell you, that is the biggest high I think I've ever had, is watching the lights come on for someone else. And, you know, I am truly grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous because you've given me a life beyond my wildest dreams, and I am so grateful. And now I get to introduce my lovely and funny husband, John.
I'm John Shires. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. Thanks, Kathy. That was really awesome. And thank you. I want to thank the committee people who got us out here. And I mean, what a crowd. I'm sitting here on the front row with a lot of my AA heroes are sitting out here, these guys whose talks I've listened to and kind of tried to take some spiritual wisdom from them. And you know, Tony over here was at our home group speaking just recently. And thank you all for putting this together and especially for inviting me. This is incredible company. When I look at the list of speakers this weekend that we're going to get to hear, I mean, it's a real honor to be included in that list. So, you know, I hope I can live up to that. I hope I can live up to what Kathy just had to say. I hope I can be funny, too, after you kind of referred to me as being so funny like three times. Well, I guess there you go. My story, my AA story, I was talking to a friend of mine today about this. I think my AA story is really the story of a coward, and that's really what it is. You know, it's the story of a guy who was a terrible coward and never knew it. A delusional coward's the worst possible kind. Kathy kind of touched on the fear, you know, just now that we alcoholics suffer from, and I don't think anybody suffers from fear in quite the same way that an alcoholic does, especially when you stop drinking. For me, that's when the fear really went insane, you know, because I mean, drinking works really, really well. People say, I can't understand why you guys drink like you do, these non-alcoholics, you know, but they don't get what we get from it. And what I get from drinking is very magical and works. It's a great solution. And today I can understand when the old timers used to say alcohol was not my problem, it was my solution. I couldn't understand that when I got here, but I can understand that today. I have been filled with fear all my life, as far back as, like Kathy talked a little bit about being a kid and just feeling real different. Yeah, man, I can relate to that. You know, all my life I've been the square peg in the round. Matter of fact, I'm still the square peg in the round hole. I just don't try to force myself in that hole anymore. You know, I'm okay with the square today. You know, I mean, I'm a big, you know, I can't use the word that I would normally use. You know, Lee, can you bleep? No, you can't bleep. But I'm a big, goofy so-and-so. That's who I am. I'm a big, goofy guy. And I've always been a big, goofy guy, but mostly uncomfortable with the fact. What it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. What I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I grew up, and I really mean what I said about the story of a coward, because I'm a kid who came up in a family, I mean, had everything. I'm from a very wealthy family, had every possible resource that you might hope to have, you know. You know, my parents were able to give their kids, I mean, everything that parents want to give to kids, you know. A good home, a good neighborhood to grow up in, great private education, you know. I grew up in Tampa, Florida. I went to a little private Greek Orthodox church school, which had a very good reputation in our town, just down the street from where I, from our home. I walked to school every day. There was a park out in front of my house. We played in the park every day after school. We played football. It was idyllic, you know. We had a big house and two cars and a neighborhood full of friends to play with, safe part of town. And I was terrified. And that's my, you know, when I think back to how I felt as a kid, I just always felt nervous. I always felt jumpy. We had Bob D. From Las Vegas out speaking at our home group here a while back, and he said something I thought was great. He said, I was terrified that all these people who I hated weren't going to like me. Isn't that great? I mean, that is really great, because I resented everybody, but I tried so hard to get everybody to like me. You know, all my life, that's how it was. And that's, you know, I didn't realize that was fear. I didn't, you know what I'm saying? I didn't understand that was fear. I call it cowardice today, and I'm okay with that. I'm a big coward, you know, and I've gotten clear on that, and that's part of my truth. But, you know, but I grew up like that. Grew up square peg, full of fear, full of resentment, in a wonderful home. I mean, it is funny when Kath and I, every once in a while, we get to do something like this where we both get to talk, and our stories are as different as possible. I mean, Kathy's mother was an alcoholic, died at the age of 39, you know, which is just crazy family life. You know, my mother was, there's a lot of alcoholism in my family. My mother's not an alcoholic. My father's not an alcoholic. They're neat people. And the house that I grew up in was, my mother actually had kind of a lousy childhood, and she had kind of done well for herself in life, and she was determined that her kids were going to have the best possible life. We went to Disney World every single year. You know, we had the first computer in the neighborhood. We had the first VCR in the neighborhood, the first everything, you know. And bottom line, I was a spoiled brat coward growing up. So let's just be really clear about that. So I'm growing up this spoiled brat, coward, you know, full of fear and resentment. And at about the age of 14, I got to take a drink. First time that I, you know, drank enough to get the effect of a drink. And it was a solution. It was a solution for all of that stuff inside, all of that stuff where I just felt ill at ease and uncomfortable and unable to get out of myself and talk to the other guys in the neighborhood, you know, the other guys on the team, the other guys at school or at church. And the girls were infinitely worse to talk to. Now, would you hand me my water, honey? Thanks. Terrified of girls, but terrified of women all my life. But a drink fixed that really well, didn't it? I mean, it just fixed the hell out of it. So, you know, take a drink, I can talk to anybody. And I can talk well to anybody. You know, and all this kind of square peg personality that I wanted to suppress, that I was ashamed of or just couldn't get out, would all come out, you know. And it was, you know the magic that we experience from a drink that non-alcoholics just don't experience. And so I was off and running. I was 15 years old, or 14 actually years old, and so you couldn't really do a lot of drinking. It was kind of, my mother was a nurse, by the way. My father was a physician. And I had the kind of household that if you walked in and you were drinking, and maybe you'd been experimenting in some little chemical engineering as well, that someone could look at you and say, "You've had 4 drinks and smoked 3 joints and taken 4 reds," you know? So you really had to keep it down. You know, you couldn't come home loaded. So, and this is my early alcoholism, right? What I would do in the mornings, I would go to school and drink before school. I'd get there like an hour early, say, "Mom, I got chess club," or some lie, you know? And get to school and drink before school. You know, we would drink and party and get loaded before school, because then by the time school got done, I'd be sober enough to go home and no one was the wiser. So I didn't do too well in school, though. I remember I had typing 2 or 3 semesters in a row. I had typing in high school, first period, and I just failed it. I was just, you know, was it a quid pro quo, you know? So I never graduated from high school as a result of that. And we're a little pressed for time tonight, so I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on that, but... You know, needless to say, and that was the deal, though. I had to be sober at 5 o'clock when I came home, and I had to be home at that time. So I just got loaded all day at school. And I dropped out. And Bill Wilson, in his story in the Big Book, talks about, "I'd prove to the world I was important." You know, it's so funny. I mean, Bill was an amazing character, right? And by the time that he became crushed by his alcoholism, he had actually achieved a lot of stuff and then lost it all. I never achieved jack, and I lost it all, you know. It's kind of a hard point to make, but I just jump ahead to tell you that I'm a high school dropout who also got a PhD in molecular biology later, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of the miracle that this deal has given me, and. And I got a lot of this, and I know there's others of you in here who got this, too, when you were a kid. Or, you know, at some point, you know, there was a spouse or a parent or a teacher or, a sister or brother who came to you and said, "You have so much potential. If you could just pull yourself together, man, you know?" Hell, if I could pull myself together, I wouldn't need you guys. I wouldn't need Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried to pull myself together. I mean, I've been seeing shrinks ever since I was 7. I've seen a lot of shrinks. And that's fine, by the way. It's just I never dealt with my alcoholism, you see. And I really do feel like I was born an alcoholic. I was born a square peg full of fear, resentful alcoholic. And it took me about 5 years of drinking. I got sober at the age of 19. And by the grace of God and you guys, I've been sober ever since. I got sober March 7, 1989. I just picked up my 20 years this spring. And clap for yourselves. Clap for yourselves. I heard it said that clapping for an alcoholic for not drinking is like clapping for a cowboy with hemorrhoids for not riding his horse. You know? So the point is, clap for yourselves, right? Because it's because of AA. But, you know, like I said, going back, I'm a high school dropout. I haven't achieved anything. I've got potential, and I'm like, yeah, I've got a lot of potential, you know? I mean, I can be egotistical and arrogant about things I haven't done yet that I think I might be able to do one day. And Kathy and I laugh a lot because I had the same sort of thing. One day I'm going to be walking down the street with my long hair and my black heavy metal t-shirt, and this limo is going to pull up, and the guy's going to get out with the shades, and man, you know, you would just, we're shooting a movie across town. We need someone who looks just like you. And that was somehow going to be how I got by in life. That was going to be. You know, but anyway, at the age of 19, I was living in Gainesville, Florida, not getting by, and I was living in this house in Gainesville, Florida, and it's amazing to be here tonight with so many of y'all, and it's funny because I know so many people. There must be a dozen or so people from my home group out here, and I want to thank you guys particularly all for coming out and supporting and Kathy and I, and so many people that I know. I mean, I have a pretty big circle of acquaintances and a pretty tight little circle of friends, you know, today, but at the age of 19, I lived behind a locked door in a flop house dump of a house in Gainesville, Florida. My world was small, and it was very, very small. It was literally a box spring and mattress with no sheets or blankets in the middle of this dumpy room in this dumpy house. And in one corner of this room was a big pile of clean laundry, or clean-ish, that I would bring home from the wash dry, the laundromat, and just kind of dump there. And then it would gradually be moved to this pile in another corner of the room over several weeks. Then it would all go back down and get washed. The house did not have electricity or gas or water. And so, you can get by, I've learned, without water for a lot of things. Because you can live without showering or brushing your teeth for long periods of time if you have to. And, if you're drinking like I drink, then you have to. The toilet becomes a real serious problem. And there have been people who've said, John, we share in a general way from the podium, but I like to tell this story because this is who you got. This is what you see is what you get. But me and this other scumbag that I was living with, who, lower companionship, right? I dropped out in high school. This guy dropped out in the sixth grade. So I looked really good alongside Steve. We were still using the toilet. And our solution for this problem was that every night, one of us would steal into the neighbor's yard and get the garden hose, very quietly run it across the fence into the bathroom window and fill that tank up and give it a good flush. Okay? Now, that's not even the sick part. The sick part is this. I thought that was so clever. I really thought I was getting one over on the man. Free water, I did not see that as insane. I did not see that as, unmanageability or any of that kind of stuff. But that's basically, so that's where I was. High school dropout, water stealer. I ended up, because of my lovely Al-Anon mother, and I'll put a plug in for Al-Anon because I'm here because of Al-Anon, you could say, because my mother had gotten into Al-Anon and it stopped bailing me out when I would call her up and say, you wouldn't believe the crazy set of circumstances that means I need $500, I ended up here in Atlanta at Ridgeview. And this is back in March of 1989. And I did not come there to get sober, but I did get sober because you guys brought meetings into Ridgeview. And they took us to you at some of the outside meetings. And so I started on this journey of recovery, and it was and continues to be really, really amazing. Because Kathy and I have a lot of similarities, too, in our early part of our talk. I just came to AA because it was the Sober Elks. It was just this great, cool place to hang out. You had all these quirky, zany people who do nothing but drink coffee, smoke cigarettes, and play poker. And at least the crowd that I ran with, that was pretty much the deal. And we went to conferences, and we went to, the young people's thing was big. I was 19 years old. I was insane. We did all of that kind of stuff. And for 4 years, my program was, it really was don't drink and go to meetings. And I did a lot of that. And I did 7 meetings a week pretty much for 4 years. And I had a lot of good times. And I had a pink cloud, like they talk about, for that first year, year and a half. And then gradually after that, it just slowly, slowly got worse. I want to say a little thing, don't drink and go to meetings is really, really good advice. Right? Really good advice when you come in here. Man, if you can not drink, go to meetings when you first get here, you got a really good chance. But if it was the only advice in Alcoholics Anonymous, we wouldn't have any literature. We wouldn't have 12 and 12s and big books and all this other stuff. And I am also aware that there are absolutely people in Alcoholics Anonymous who cannot drink and go to meetings and have that be their whole program and stay sober for decades and years, 20 and 30 and 40 years. And that's great. And I don't want to tell anybody who's doing that or who's ever done that that's wrong or that's not AA, because AA is what keeps you sober, right? That's what it is. So for different people, it seems to be a little different, and that's fine. What I can just say, John Shires tried that program, which was, 7 meetings a week and don't drink and, hang out and do a lot of fellowship stuff. And at 4 years sobriety, I was insane. I was, I felt like I needed to be, this is some of my delusion. I felt like I needed to be this pillar of sobriety. Like, I was the guy who was the young guy who had 4 years, and I needed to look good. I needed to sound good in AA, and I needed to go to meetings and share great stuff. Bill busted me on this one time, actually. You know, I would go to, I would do this my first few years all the time, and it was pretty much unconscious, but I would go to, like, the 11 o'clock meeting, you know, at NABBA on Sunday, and hear this really great little spiritual wisdom, you know, from some of the old timers. Then I would go over to the 8 o'clock meeting that night and try to pass it off as my own kind of thing, you know. And, you know, did that kind of stuff all the time. It was regular. You know, the dishonesty that I have is so complete that I don't see that stuff. I'm the guy who's, you know, I'm 6 months sober, and I'm sitting in a meeting, raising my hand, I get called on, and I preface whatever, you know, lie that I'm about to tell by saying, you know, back when I was first getting sober, you know, like just putting all that little alcoholic polish on things, you know, like this little phrases, little stuff. I mean, I'm a liar, I'm a cheat, I'm a thief, and I'm a coward. And I finally got clear on some of that, and it took me basically 4 years in Alcoholics Anonymous until I finally was going so insane. I was either going to kill myself, which I'm too big a coward to do, or I'm going to go get loaded because this doesn't work. I started to think AA doesn't work. But luckily, I ran into some people, and I got involved in a totally different way, and Kathy was kind of talking about it. I hadn't had a sponsor those first 4 years, you know. Actually, it's not totally true. Is Ernie Cook here tonight by any chance? I was hoping he'd be here because I could tell this story. I got Ernie C's phone number the very first week I got out of rehab because one of the counselors there said, hey, that guy'd be a good sponsor. And I knew how to play the game. I'm an alcoholic. I mean, obviously I'm going to butter up the counselor if I go over there and get that guy's phone number. So I got Ernie's phone number and told everybody Ernie was my sponsor and never, ever called him. But for years, people asked me, for like the first 2 years that I was in A, if you asked if I had a sponsor, which a lot of people said stuff to me like, do you have a sponsor? I would say, you know, it's Ernie. Yeah, old Ernie over there from the, you know, the Saturday night meeting. And they would say, oh, yeah, Ernie's great. You know, oh, yeah, he's great, you know. But that's just the kind of guy that I am. And when you, you know, you take away the, I love what Clancy says, that, you know, one of the ways you know an alcoholic is when you take the alcohol away from him, he gets worse. I started getting worse. That all the character stuff that I could kind of deal with and suppress by not, you know, by drinking and by partying and getting loaded and running around, I couldn't do anymore. And it just started to, it's progressive. Even when I'm not drinking, my alcoholism is progressive. If I'm not treating it spiritually with the tools that we use, which is the 12 steps, it just gets worse. And so at 4 years, it had gotten so bad. But luckily, I ran into some guys, and I got dialed into a meeting. And Dennis Sanfilippo, who left us several years ago, and a lot of you guys out there know him, Dennis Sanfilippo had a big book study for just years and years in his house. And Dennis was my kind of guy because he was foul-mouthed, and he was mean, and then he would hug you to death. You know what I'm saying? And he was just exactly what I needed. And Dennis, you know, he and some of the guys that he sponsored, Hamilton B. and Kerry G. and several other guys. And I know some of them are here tonight. And if I'm leaving anybody out, then, you know, forgive me. But a lot of these guys really saved my neck, you know. And I got into the steps. And, I learned something. There's that bit in the big book where it says, selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem. And I read that my first year. And I thought, thank God I haven't got those problems. That's the God's honest truth. That's what it means to be as dishonest and delusional as a lot of us are. I mean, I just didn't see that, you know. I thought I was a really caring and misunderstood individual who had a really, really big heart and who cared about other people and was just constantly, my actions were misconstrued and people didn't understand. And I did that first inventory, just like it's laid out in the big book, and I started to see, this is the real miracle. Don Pritz, who's another one of our great old-timers who's passed on to the big meeting in the sky, on a tape, he said, it's a spiritual awakening anytime an alcoholic sees any of the truth about himself. And I saw, I had a spiritual awakening. After 4 years, I did an inventory, and it wasn't nearly as big a deal. I was terrified to do an inventory, as we all are. It was not a big deal. And it was actually an awful inventory. I've still got the inventory. And looking back at it, I'm still so delusional in that inventory. I'm still so completely not seeing much of anything. But I started to get a little inside, you know, a little bit of information about the truth about John, which is that I'm really full of fear, and I'm self-centered, really self-centered, and I didn't even really know the depths of my self-centeredness yet at that point, but I was starting to see that, you know, I'm selfish and self-centered, and I got a lot of fear. And over the next, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years, I have a second pink cloud. I mean, I got back into this thing in a big way. I met my lovely wife. We got married. Went off to graduate school in Connecticut. I'll tell you a funny story about Connecticut. So we moved to New Haven, Connecticut. And it's a big deal. I'm going to Yale now. I'm going to be somebody, you know, and all this. And Kath and I are up there. And anybody who's in here, any real alcoholic who has ever moved in recovery will know what I'm talking about. It doesn't matter where you move from. If you move from City A to City B, the AA in City B stinks. And we hated the AA in New Haven. We hated it. Oh, these people don't know what they're doing, and they're going to kill all these alcoholics. I mean, it's just awful, you know? And so we're struggling, and we're kind of been there like 3 or 4 months. And so we said, well, we got to keep active. We got to stay active. We got to carry the torch, you know? So we go to the Connecticut State Convention that year. And so we're sitting there, and it's on Saturday, and you know, we don't know anything about what's going on at Connecticut State, and Bill Sanders is the speaker that night, and he comes over and he introduces us to this great bunch of folks who we ended up getting together with and starting this home group, which is one of the best groups that I've ever been a part of. Not quite as good as the group my home group now, but it's a darn good group, and it's still going strong, I'm happy to say. I still talk to some of those people up there. So you never know how things are going to roll in recovery. You know, you can't see everything. My job is to stop caring about how I feel and just put in the action. You know what I'm saying? And I really believe that more and more and more. My feelings don't enter into the program of recovery that I'm trying to practice today. They really don't. I don't always live up to that, but I spent the first half of my, the first 4 years of my recovery and every bit of time up to that point in my life worrying about how I felt and when I was going to get mine. And when I was going to feel good, you know, I used to think meditation didn't work because when you would meditate, and I would try to meditate, you know, like the whole thing, sitting cross-legged, like, om, om, you know, and as if meditation was some kind of low-grade orgasm, you know. It's not. It's not. My spirituality does not work like that. So I got into our steps. Let me tell you, so there were some amends that I had to make. There was one man in particular. I want to tell you about it. So, again, I'm a spoiled brat, rich kid, coward. And my parents divorced, and at one point, one of the many psychiatrists that I saw decided that I needed a male role model, and I needed to move out of mom's house into my dad's house, which was great, because my dad was a doctor, and he wasn't around a lot because, you know, he's a doctor. You got to go to the hospital in the middle of the night. Your hours are weird. My third stepmother, third mother, whatever, his wife, who was 22 years younger than him and, you know, 9 years older than me, was really cool initially because she's like, you know, she was kind of an ex-hippie a little bit, and she kind of had partied, and she was like, yeah, you can smoke pot, just keep it on the patio and all this. And it would have been a good deal if I had not been an alcoholic who takes, you know, give them an inch, they take a mile. And so I really put a lot of strain on their marriage. And one night, you know, after some alcoholic shenanigans had happened, in our unit of this, we live in the 16th floor of this high-rise building on the water in Tampa. And we had kind of messed up our place, messed up one of the neighbors' place. There was vomit up and down one of the corridors. I mean, this is a really hoity-toity building. Like, the owner of the Bucks lived there, and the mayor lived there. And you just didn't do that kind of stuff. One day, as a result of some of this kind of constant stuff, there was a real nice lobby, very well appointed, you know, tile floor, leather bound walls, all this kind of stuff. And it was one of those marquee signs with the little white, really fancy letters that you put little announcements up on. And the board of directors of the building had a meeting about the Shires children. Because there's more than one of me, of us. But they had a meeting about the Shires children. And this announcement appeared on the board. The Shires children are disallowed from all public areas of the building. Okay? Yeah, I thought that was hysterical. Right? I'm like, yeah, we party so hard, we're not allowed anywhere, you know? But, you know, I can't even imagine how my father must have felt coming home from, you know, a hard day trying to save lives and do all that stuff and stand there next to, like, the owner of the Bucks and have to read that sign, the embarrassment that he must have felt. See, I can appreciate that today. I got some kids today, you know, and they screw up a lot, too. And so I can appreciate that. That's a whole nother talk. But, you know, I did not have it in me. The self-centered, you know, fear-based person that I was did not have it in me to even appreciate that my father might have some serious feelings about that. And so this one particular night, it was vomit all over the building. And I had passed out, and my stepmother came bursting in with an empty bottle of vodka at 1 o'clock in the morning, screaming at me, throwing this bottle of vodka at me, and, you know, and through my drunken haze, I could understand that there was at least a few problems with her story. There was a gap in her story that I couldn't quite, you know, that I could see. And so at 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke up again with this plan. I got up. I found her sleeping on the couch because she and my father had obviously had a big fight about what to do about John. A lot of people had fights and meetings, what to do about John, because that's the effect that we have on people, you know. And I woke her up and basically painted this huge lie. And I won't get into it too much because I'm going to have to wind it up here. But I painted this huge lie and had her crying and apologizing to me for being the bad guy. You know, because she had, it was really my brother who had done everything. Unbeknownst to me, I had actually been witnessed doing the crime. And so her friend told her about the witnessing part next day. And so I was even more in trouble than I had originally been. And it was a pretty serious situation. Never had any sense of that. But when I got into the steps and I started looking at this stuff, I was able to sit face to face with her. And there was actually a couple of more things too that happened that I could never share from the podium. It might surprise some of you. You know, to get straight with her, you know, and she and my dad have actually got divorced, and I'm probably closer to her than I am with my dad. It's really kind of funny how things work out in AA. But anyway, I got into this, you know, starting at 4 years sober, got into the program, got into the steps. And Kev, we've kind of launched out into the world. And like Kathy said, things don't always go as smoothly as you want them to go. This guy who was just terrified and was a coward, by and large, most of my life is pretty good today as a result of this deal. But it's not perfect. I sometimes feel like, let's talk about the dishonesty a little bit more. I love to make myself look like I'm better than I am, or make myself sound like things are better than they are, or, you know, like if I bought a car, I have to tell you I got it for 20 or 30% less than I actually got it for, so you'll think I'm a really shrewd negotiator, you know, or something like that. And if I sell a car, then I got to tell you I sold it for $2,000 or $3,000 more than I actually sold it for, so you'll know that I'm just no one to be trifled with. So I like to say, for me, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is not about being good, okay? I mean, all my life I knew what good, I know the difference between right and wrong. That's never been the problem. I just was not willing, or I was terrified to put in the effort needed to do the right thing, or my efforts to do the right thing were just, they just went badly. But it's not about being good in here today. And I think I spent a lot of time spinning my tires those first few years just trying to be good, okay? If I could be good, especially if I could be good in my own power, then I would not need a higher power. I would not need the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't need you guys, and I wouldn't need these meetings. And I could have saved myself a ton of effort. It's not about being good. It's about doing the right actions. It's about meeting the conditions that the program sort of lines out for me. You know, the program says, here's these steps. You might not believe it. Are you willing to try it and do it and see what happens? Okay. If you are, then I think that's enough, right? It says in our book, just a little tiny bit of willingness, right? It says just on that simple basis of, yes, I'm willing to believe that there might be a higher power, followed by an effort to do these steps, that's enough. That's enough for us to have a spiritual awakening as a result of the process. You know, I'm not good today. I still chew tobacco. I still like to, sometimes the phone rings and I don't answer it, you know, because I don't love all you guys so much. You know, I'm like, I don't want to talk to that guy right now. I'm still self-centered, you know, I'm still not averse to the occasional nudie photo, okay? The point I'm making here is that I've been a guy who's liked to promote myself a lot of my life as something that I'm not. You know, I'm just a regular alcoholic. You know, I don't want to be a special alcoholic. I really do believe that a lot of times it's actually our character defects that hold us, that bind us together a little bit, that make us, you know, weave us together in that special way. So I don't ever want to get so good that I can't be an alcoholic. You know, I love the new people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those of you who are new or here tonight, I hope you will keep coming and give this a shot, even when it's really, really difficult. Our home group does a meeting on Tuesday nights at Peachford Hospital, and to see these guys come in, you know, like we do, Kathy was talking about it, you know, and with her girls and the guys that I sponsor, and even people that I don't sponsor but end up in our group, and I see them getting sponsored, and I see them working the steps, and I hear them sharing in our big book study some little breakthrough that they had, you know, with their own step work. That is the good stuff. And to show you how good it is, the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you have almost all the steps are covered in just about 30 pages. And then there's an entire chapter just for step 12, right? Entire chapter just for step 12 in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really think that's the deal. I'm not in action where the spirit really flows unless I'm doing that working with others part. You know, the steps are not tools to make me feel good. It doesn't matter how I feel. Actually, I'm done. It doesn't matter how I feel. I really do believe that more and more. My program has become simpler and simpler. It does not matter how I feel. It just matters how I act. You know, and if I act according to the dictates of a higher power and a sponsor and a home group for a period of time, the funny thing is, and stop caring about how I feel, I end up feeling good. It's that part of stopping caring, you know, that I think the thing to do. And like I said, there's a lot of times I don't want to do what I have to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? I mean, the phone rings, and you know, and you do this, right? You look at it. Oh, I don't want to talk to that guy. You know? Hey, man, how's it going? You know? That's the truth, right? Bill's nodding over here. That's the truth. I sponsor a lot of guys, and I love the guys that I sponsor. They come to my house many nights a week. There's people at our house. You know, Kathy or I have somebody regularly over at the house, and the weekends are very full of people, too. There's never a time that someone comes over that I'm like, yay, I got a sponsee coming over. That's not how it works for me. It's okay. I got a sponsee coming over, you know. It's kind of a grudging thing. But then they leaving, and we've sat and talked for an hour, hour and a half, and all of a sudden I'm lit up and I'm filled with spirit again, and this program works. And that's the way it's worked for me. So anyway, I've pretty much reached my time limit. I think I've said everything that I wanted to say. So thanks again for having us, and God bless all y'all.